to crediting performers for their contributions to what a show is and how it looks. They'll say, oh, it's Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma, or it's Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods, and dismiss or not really recognize. In the workshops, those performers contributed as well.
And I will also add the way it keeps shifting and it keeps evolving with every performer that steps in. One thing I kept thinking to myself, why I love musicals so much is because there's something about interpretation that kind of reveals truth in a way. It gives you a glimpse into that performer, how that performer takes it, how that performer shapes it. For people tuning in, we just started going. I got Sundi on with me again. Hi, say hi.
Hey.
Did I say your name correctly? Glad.
Yes, you did.
I'm trying.
With a guy. It's Galinda.
Oh, God. I have my own personal Glinda coming in to step in. I felt like there was absolutely no one more appropriate than you to discuss Wicked with me. Let's give general impressions. How are you feeling about this moment in culture? Wicked is here.
I think it's super exciting for movie musicals specifically because they've got movie musicals correct because it treated it like a strong fantasy film, a good comedy that was also using the tools of the movie musical. It wasn't like we're making a musical film. It opens up and you see Elphaba's hat and then you see the flying monkeys punch through the window. This is a good start to a fantasy film.
You see little Dorothy as well.
Oh gosh, tipping down the yellow brick road in her little heels.
Get a little dog too.
God, that monster. That little monster woman. It's great. We're going to get our thoughts about the film, general thoughts about it specifically. I feel like starting off by, how are you? Sundi, give us the update since we've last heard your voice on this podcast. How are you? What have you been up to?
I'm good. I'm all right. I'm good. I'm doing well. I'm still performing in the area. I'm carrying on my queer cabaret drag open mic night in Wolverhampton. That's going really, really well. I've got other things lined up that I can't talk about right now, but it's all very, very exciting.
Ooh.
Things are going well. I'm very happy with this.
Is she preparing a packet?
No. If I was, I wouldn't be able to say anyway.
Ooh,
if she appears, then no, wait, no, I shan't. See, that's how I know Wicked's had a hit on me because I've gone full mid-Atlantic, Glinda.
You're a bit like, Rue gave us all we ever wanted.
Stop, because if we were talking about Drag Race, we could really break down which the Rue girls are Elphabas and which ones are Glindas, which ones have resisted the structures and the machine, and which ones have thought, I can operate within this and do good within this sphere.
We can also get into which ones are the Nessa Rose, who just became a villain in the end, unwittingly.
Unwitting villain in the end.
Without even doing much of anything. Was just stank.
Poor Jeremy, I should say.
Yeah, love and light. Sending love, light, and strength to Jeremy.
And legit adoration, because very, very talented.
He's very talented.
So talented.
I must say, it is really appropriate that we dovetailed into a conversation about RuPaul.
She is my scar.
As soon as we started talking about The Wizard of Oz and Wicked. How about we just get the basics? So tell me about your relationship with Wicked. When did you come across it? Did you get the musical or the book first in your life?
The musical was first in my life by way of Glee. And then, no, wait, I'm lying. My first intro to
thank
Wicked.
Thank God. Can I just say thank God? I was about to log off this call. How dare you?
No. It was still Glee, but it was the episode Roads Less Taken. I hadn't heard of Kristen Chenoweth, even though I knew I'd seen her in films looking back on her career. I was like, oh, that was her. So I went to like a Kristen Chenoweth deep dive and then discovered Wicked through that. And then Idina Menzel and it was Idina and Rent and all that kind of stuff. It was through knowing those two ladies. I would have been secondary school. So I was like a teenager. So not too far off it opening in London or on Broadway. I've only recently got into the book for it. The past few weeks, I was like, okay, let me really jump into an Oz hole because I've seen Wizard of Oz. I'd watched Return to Oz. I'd watched Journey Back to Oz. I've seen The Wiz, obviously, as well.
Were you a fan of the Oz story and world beforehand? Or just familiar?
Just familiar. Mm. I knew of it. It wasn't one that I thought, ooh, this is the universe I probably want to sit into.
Yeah.
Looking into it now, I like it as a playing space.
I think I have a similar relationship about how I got into it. Because I know about Wizard of Oz was from the ether. And I know about those books from the ether, but it's never really something that moved me or was really big in my life. I was doing research about the history of the play, and it was giving a bit of insight about the history of The Wizard of Oz, how it was like a moderate hit, but then it grew into this classic juggernaut because it started airing on television and was one of those first films that kept airing on television regularly. And that kind of built up a fandom, or at least a place in the American household, and that filtered out in globalism because American culture reiterates this theme. And as a playing space, it has been reiterated quite a lot, and there's been a lot of different versions. What I really enjoy about this world is exactly what you're saying. Frank Elbaum, since that original story, which I think even was an interpretation of local folklore that he just put down on paper, people approached it by interpreting it. Like The Wizard of Oz that we all know from the film with Judy Garland and Margaret Hamilton is different than the book in significant ways. And that just keeps happening. Like I said a little bit at the start about how I really love the act of interpretation and why I really love musicals, because interpretation reveals a bit of a truth about it. And I think The World of Oz, whenever you can return to it and see, I guess, a specific mode in culture and in thinking and in art at the time. Similarly, I came to the musical first before I came to the book, but I'm like a lore whore, so I fell deeply into it. And then I listened to the musical, I really liked it, and I went to see it on the West End. After that, I read the book and then had feelings about that. And now this Wicked moment feels like a bit of a, I don't know, a revival of a younger version of me.
Which, question.
There's something really nice and comforting about it. Yeah, go on.
Do you remember who your Glinda and Elphaba were when you saw it?
I do. Do you?
I saw an understudy for the Elphaba, so I'm sure I remember her name. But she was understudy that went on to do it full time anyway. I think I saw Nikki Bentley as Elphaba. Glinda was Louise Dierman.
Okay, so we were on the same rung because I saw Rachel Tucker as my Elphaba. Louise Dierman as my Glinda.
Oh, yeah, because it was meant to be Rachel that was on to be the full time, yeah?
Yeah.
That's so funny. Like, in that same kind of span of time, I would have went with my secondary school trip. I think I was in my first year of sixth form when I saw it.
Yeah, I know, and I just absolutely loved it. Louise Dierman, who went on, I think, to become the first Glinda to turn into Elphaba on the stage. Like, she really made me fall in love with her role as well, which I think on first listen, I was more so attracted to Elphaba, but yeah, she won me over live.
Louise Dierman was such an interesting one to play. Glinda from a musical perspective, because yes, she's soprano, but you can hear there's that kind of belt. Richness and body to her voice, and that there is that kind of almost rocky belt to her voice that you could hear with it. One of the interesting things about Wicked was that there were these two female leads with two very different distinct skill sets and tones to their voice, and they'd approached the material differently because it was written for those two very different voices. And it's so interesting to see Louise Dierman as a Glinda first, because I know that there have been some. Annalie Ashford was an American Glinda. She auditioned for Elphaba first because she is a crazy high belter, but she did her audition, she did the war cry, and they went yeah at the end, and the casting team burst out laughing and they're like, we've got a comedian here, we've got a funny soprano here, let's have her come in for Glinda instead. And then she went on to be one of the earlier Glindas. I've heard rumors that Shoshana Bean auditioned for Glinda or would have sang some of Glinda's stuff in the earlier points.
I can see that.
Yeah, because she does quite literally have that kind of edgy,
she has a soprano voice. Yeah,
but she's a full classical soprano. Sick woman. I
know. Shoshana is a monster.
She is unfair. Oh my gosh. You know what? If there was a way in which it would make sense for her to be in the second film, bring her in.
Mm-hmm.
Bring her in.
You know what? That's maybe one of my dings, is that I like the cameos of Vidina and Kristen, but I wish there were more cameos. I wish everybody else was just like a different Elphaba. Carrie Ellis was in there though.
Carrie Ellis was in there.
Yeah, she was. I think she was in like the Emerald City at some point, but I noticed her, I remember.
I know Alice Fern played Glinda's mom, and she was one of the London Elphabas. Which was cute. But yeah, they needed more of the people in there. Just have them in there doing something cute. Just something.
I really love that we started talking about the different demands on the voice, because one thing about this musical is, it feels a bit odd to say, but this is like a vocal music, right? There's others that aren't really. You know what I'm saying? Right,
yeah.
This is something that has demands on the vocals that is very, very precise. This is a vocal thing.
I remember it was Jessica Vosk that said, when you're playing Elphaba, you go on and the first time she sings, it's an 11 o'clock number. It is that intense and that demanding. And then the songs stay up there as well. There's a Wizard and I. And then it pairs down a little bit for I'm Not That Girl. But then you get to Defying Gravity. And then you get No Good Deed in the second act.
She has like six I Want songs.
It's a workout.
It is.
It's insane that a role was written like this when you think about it.
It
like,
is.
But at the same time, top of the show, Glinda's got to be warm and ready to go. She has got to have everything going on and up there.
You're hitting C, the first number. It's happening. Not, get ready.
At the top of the show, sometimes Megan Hill to Chris Chenoweth got up to like the E at the top above the soprano scene. It's like, this is insane work that you're doing this. But again, we're talking about vocal giants here, like Megan Hilty, Kristen Chenoweth, to bring it to more towards the film. Ariana as well, who had... Are we going to talk about the casting now? Can we do that now? Because I've got something kind of controversial to say.
Oh, do you? Oh, I just wanted to make a point about, yeah, this is like a really vocally taxing one. So I think that is partly why we really deep dive and dig into the weeds when it comes to these tracks and these choices that these performers made. But also that kind of explains the role that these two have taken on in musical theater. These sort of became classic roles in the oeuvre of performers. It's worth taking a second to hold space.
I didn't know that was happening.
For the important legacy of people who really shaped and carved these roles into this position where this was a very popular musical, but it's entering another echelon of awareness. Or there's a reason why YouTube is filled with all these compilations of different Elphabas and different Glindas doing these notes in their own different ways. Because, yeah, this is a very important role. And I'm really, really glad that we have a chance to discuss it. And I guess that leads us in perfectly. Elphaba, Glinda. 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 Sunday, what is this that you have to say about Galinda?
When the film was announced, it was happening. Ariana wasn't my first choice that came to mind. My first choice was Duff Cameron in terms of who I could perceive doing it. I know she did music with that. I know she's good at comedy. I also know that she is classically trained soprano. I've heard that part of her voice before, and a lot of people have when she did Lighten the Piazza. Ariana Grande was announced, however, I was like, this makes perfect sense. We know that she started off doing comedy anyway, and it is that kind of broad comedy for a live audience kind of thing that she did with, when she was Cat Valentine. That makes sense. We know she not only can sing high, but we also, at this point when it was announced, we knew she could be very malleable with her voice. We knew that she was a clever enough singer to know how to make her voice sound different in certain ways. So even when people are like, oh, can she do the soprano stuff, the notes are there.
Yeah.
How she approaches them just needs to be different. So I had no doubts Ariana would be a really good choice. What got me, here's a crazy thing. I'm not going to imply that she's a victim of racism here.
Okay, go on.
But I do feel like, because whenever people talk about her being a weird choice for Glinda, they always bring up Side to Side or Seven Rings or that particular era of Ariana.
Africana.
No, it did feel low-key racialized. It did racialize people saying she wouldn't be a good Glinda. And we live in a post-Britney Johnson world. We live in a post, I think it's Lucy St. Louis world. We've got black Glindas, and it was like, but she's not even black, but she caught the strays. She caught the strays of racism.
She had coded herself with black culture for long enough that maybe it took her away from the public imagination as this epitome of blondness. Because that's what Glinda is, character-wise, isn't she? She's like the white woman of the show.
I think when you first see Glinda, the musical does a good job of getting you to really position her as Glinda from The Wizard of Oz. It's that image that they do really well to evoke. Even like when the costume designers did a video and talked about how there are bubbles in Glinda's tiara and how a lot of Glinda's outfits are designed around these small little circles to evoke the idea of the bubble. And even though we've had a wide range of Glindas that do look quite different, when it came to the film, they really evoked that original... Was it Billy Burke who played her in the film?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Burke, who was that body of that kind of idealized, maternal, caring, safe, and aspirational femininity. And Ariana Grande, she did have to embody that in the film, and she does. What does send me, though, she is doing this incredible vocal masterclass singing No One Wants the Wicked, but then she steps down from the bubble, and she's the same height as a child. She is so tiny.
Don't come for the short girls. How dare you?
No, I just thought, despite all the presence that she gives, this really grounds the character, which makes sense, because the rest of the piece is grounding these characters and putting them in context. How did you feel about Ariana? How did you feel about her? She was announced, and how did you feel about her in the film? Because in the film, she was spectacular.
Yeah, let's just get that out of the way. She was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
How did I feel about the announcement of her casting? I don't know. My whole feeling about the Wicked movie when it was first being announced was like, I don't believe this is going to happen.
That was
my thing, because they kept trying to do it for years upon years, and then it just wouldn't happen. I was taking it not very seriously, but then when it actually was being filmed and stuff, I was like, okay. Intrigued. Like you were saying, I knew she had those notes in her, and I was interested in seeing how she was going to like adapt herself, how from pop star to musical theater Glinda, especially as a role that is so well known. I was just like interested in the process more than anything. But I think Dove Cameron would have been interesting as Glinda. What I really like about what she did with it, though, she really thwarted my expectation, because my ultimate Glinda is Megan Hilty, who played it like a manic child.
I was just watching her popular earlier, and
deranged child. That's very different from this version. Ariana's Glinda, she's an airhead. You know what I mean? She's very vain. She's self-centered, but you get the sense that there is something there. And one of my reactions when I was first listening to the music was, it almost feels like it's underplayed, because I listened to the soundtrack before I watched the film, as I do. It almost feels like her vocals are calmer. And I didn't expect that. And I wasn't sure how I'd feel about that. But then when I sat with the film, I just fell into it. I bought this interpretation of Glinda. She's gotten a lot of acclaim, but I found that the musical theater heads are not sure how they feel about her Glinda, and partly maybe that's the whole pop star thing that I think is coming into effect.
See, you mentioned about her sounding calmer on the cast recording. I think for No One Mourns the Wicked, there is that kind of sense of restraint. There's almost like a Julie Andrews-ness to her delivery as well, and it's of course Glinda wants to position herself as this poised together, because bear in mind, No One Mourns the Wicked, if you're looking about the timeline of the show, Glinda's doing this straight after For Good.
Yeah.
So there was this sense of she's not going full out in terms of what she's doing vocally. Yeah, there's a restraint to it, and she's deliberately sounding really poised and really together. I like what you said about Airhead, because Ariana's Glinda seems to very much...
It's Cher from Clueless.
The funny thing about Popular, that scene was called the Clueless scene, because it was evocative of that scene in Clueless where there is that makeover.
Yeah.
So that comparison absolutely makes sense, but it's almost like she doesn't really process things beyond what she is directly concerned or thinking about. And it's that throughout the film that she isn't really contextualizing what's going on around her, because it's not what she is focused on.
How do you feel about Cynthia Erivo?
See, when it was announced, I was like, of course, this is going to be great. She's Avengers level talented. She's ridiculous. Next thought was like, why has she not done this on stage before? I feel like she should have done this by now. That just feels right.
I think it was a time thing, because she was on movies around the time where she was big enough to be Elphaba.
I do think that her Elphaba, there's a sense that she's just accepted, this is how people respond to me, this is what's happened, this is the world.
Resignation.
Yeah, I can't hide it, I can't stop it, it is what it is. Which is why those moments where she just get excited or happy, it feels a lot more satisfying, because it's like she's seen beyond what she resigned herself to.
And also, like, when she breaks for emotion, I think is really powerful. The Ozda scene, the dance sequence.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they got me. When they zoom in and what Cynthia was doing with her face, it always feels like the tear isn't far off from this Elphaba's eyes. She's ready to break down, but also just like keeping it at bay.
That sequence was... I feel like when it comes to Glinda and Elphaba's relationship, it's that Glinda is the context in which Elphaba makes sense for people. When Elphaba's doing her dance and then Glinda does it with that, it's, oh, well, this was a partner dance. This makes sense more as a partner dance. And Elphaba doing it by herself is what made it seem particularly off or strange. Doing it with the way that bits of the choreo were, with someone mirroring that, like with the shoulder movements and like the strong arms being held out, someone mirroring that or doing that with you made a lot more sense. Glinda being this framework in which Elphaba is, I don't want to say more palatable, but through which Elphaba can be understood.
Yeah.
That's what I thought about certain moments in the film. And again, this one particular line that I really want to zoom in on. I feel like Cynthia is such a clear choice for Elphaba. It's, what can you say? She is fantastic. And the way she suggested aesthetic things for Elphaba, like the nails and the micro braids and all of those things, was that thing about the authenticity and the value in interpretation and what it means when different people embody these different characters. It was all of those things as well that Cynthia really brought to it. I do want to say, vocally, it felt like she's already incredibly precise as a singer, but that made the moments where she does explode out so much more thrilling. Like, there is such a change in placement when she goes into the, and I'll stand there with the wizard. Such a change in placement, and it's this is unbridled excitement. She has stopped restraining herself, which is what she's had to learn to do. Similar thing in Defying Gravity.
Yeah, like you said, she's very precise with her vocals, and you can also hear that in the placement of the riffs. It feels like they're escaping her momentarily before she like brings it back in to sing the notes in points. One of my favorite songs is I'm Not That Girl, and she does this one part about Glinda, and she does a little run there. Catch and release vocally, like you're saying, she was born for this. How do you feel about the reception to the film at this moment? There's been a point being made online about how a lot of people are heaping praise on Ariana and her Glinda as opposed to Cynthia and her Elphaba.
People are more Ariana focused, mainly because out of the two, she is the bigger name, but also throughout the film, we are laughing with Ariana. The role Glinda gives you so many opportunities to laugh. So many opportunities to have that immediate response. And that offset with a character that is a lot more grounded, a lot more heartfelt. People respond to the funny bits a lot more immediately. So that kind of stays with people more.
Yeah, it's a firework. It's a little pop. I really agree with you there. I always feel like the first act, even though a lot of my favorite Elphaba songs are in there and a lot of the best songs are there, the first act, Elphaba is really just one mode. Shy, reserved, until the end. That's her breakout moment. And she has more of an emotional range in the second act. She gets to act more rather than just do it through the singing, while Glinda, she's the comic character, so she has a lot more moments in the first act, and in the second act she fades a bit more and she's just there to have a very different kind of role. And I think maybe that's part of what's contributing to the discourse, as well as the pop star of it all, but also the misogynoir of it all. It's all mixed. It's an interesting situation, especially as we're gearing up towards the Oscar talk. It'll be interesting to see what they do putting forward.
The pop star of it all is very much contributes to why people are focusing more on Ari as well, because again, Ariana was a question mark for people when she was announced. So that she has had to have that public story of how she prepared for Glinda, how she became the character, what that meant for her in terms of her career. There was one interview she did where she mentioned that she had to, or she was tempted to stop one of her tours so she could repair. Now that story in and of itself, that's interesting in the wider context. If you are known as a musical theatre actor, stepping in to play a musical theatre role in a film adaptation for a musical that you very well could have smashed in London or on Broadway, and people wouldn't have doubted that, less of a story. But of course, the misogynoir of it all, that does tie in, especially when I see the UK press as well. Cynthia Erivo, I think she's president of RADA or something. There is like a drama school that she is basically high position in. And the UK media, I thought, would be screaming about that because she's from the UK, trained by UK training. There's a lot that the UK could take pride in with Cynthia. But there was so much talk about Ariana. It's quite crap that, again, you can be this amazing, incredible talent, but if you are black, and if you are black in the UK, them look here.
Yeah, that is true. And Cynthia's not been that great with the American audience, so maybe that's also contributing. But hey, it's interesting, but they did give us a great film.
Oh, fantastic film.
Let's be thankful about that. I did also want to take a moment to talk about the political themes, because I've been really trying to settle my feelings about engaging in this big old capitalist commercial money grab moment when it's a story that's about the rise of fascism, authoritarianism. How do you feel about that?
It reminded me of Les Mis, because again, Les Mis is meant to be a story where someone that has been done wrong by the system tries to make right the wrongs he has done. And in the midst of that, there is this kind of small rebellion that happens. And with musical theatre being such a middle and upper class art form in terms of who really accesses it, especially the mega musicals, it's tricky because people don't realistically see where they would be in that world. They don't see themselves as the people that would be in the wrong. They see themselves as the protagonists, when in reality, they are a lot more likely to be socially or politically aligned with those that the characters are trying to resist. I saw someone say that a lot of us are more Glinda than we'd like to admit, because someone said, you lot couldn't even give up Starbucks. And it's when capitalism plays into it. And it's really bizarre to think of when you think about what Gregory Maguire was trying to do with the book and the things that inspired him, like when he saw the propaganda with regards to things that America was doing politically in the Middle East, and he saw all the things that society will do to create a villain and how someone becomes evil, all that deep stuff. And in the face of it, there are, you can go to Cineworld and go to cinema and buy a Glinda cup and just feed into the same system that the musical sets itself up to say, actually, these things need to change. But I also think the musical's quite savvy in how it shows how you can have the best intentions but still be complicit. Again, I find myself dipped straight into the tracks One Short Day. They are essentially in the hub of where all the thinking around this rise of fascism is going on. They are right there in this place that positioned itself as almost like Disney World, this glorious kind of playground where everything seems utopian, and it's not till you look back at it you think, wait a second, none of the animals they meet in that Emerald City are talking. But they are so wrapped up in the excitement of it and the joy of it and the joy of the mythologizing around us that it portrays, they do lose sight of it for a moment. But it's tricky carrying those two things in. I love this piece, I love what it says, but it's that contradiction when something gets really big and it's talking about fascism and talking about resistance, it puts a cap on how much you can talk about it.
I'm really glad you brought up the original intentions of the book as well. I think that's really important and gets lost in the conversation a lot. I mean, it is a difficult moment. I always fall towards the end of saying, in a capitalist commercial culture, I think the ethics, what it comes to us partaking in it, are murky. And I think escapism is fine and forgivable. Enjoying something is fair. We live in such a hellish space at the moment that find your joy wherever you can get it and fall deeply. And if that's wicked at the moment, then good, have fun. At the same time, it's really important we don't lose sight as we engage of all the other implications. It is a very commercial enterprise. Ultimately, it's going to end up rewarding people who are already billionaires and so on. Those are very serious issues. And one of the best things that we can do is engage with it with fullness of scope. Just be a conscientious consumer. Maybe don't buy that wicked mug, but enjoy the film. And that's fine. I'm really glad you brought up the intentions of the book. We kind of skirted around, but I think it's worth talking about a little bit. So the book was an idea that Gregory Maguire came up with in 1989. And by 1995, it was out. And it was inspired by a lot of different things, specifically what was going on with America and what was going on in the Middle East in the midst of the Iraq and Kuwait war. It was inspired partly by Saddam Hussein greeting hostages in Baghdad and the international incident that that caused, by this cool kid killing of James Bulger in Liverpool, and that all conspired to inspire Gregory Maguire to explore this theme of darkness, of humanity and destruction. He went to The Wicked Witch from The Wizard of Oz, specifically the film version, because of his relationship with it as a child. We all know the musical The Wizard of Oz. Margaret Hamilton played the Green Witch from Oz. She was a Green Witch for a lot of different reasons, but speaking of the commercial point that we were talking about, one of the reasons reasons that she was is because it's a Technicolor film. They wanted to dazzle audience to try and get them to come and see the movie. So they painted her green, partly because of that. It's an interesting little historical point there. The Wicked musical itself, by 2000, it was being workshopped with Kristen Chenoweth and I believe originally Idina Menzel, but then she left, and then Stephanie J. Block, and then it premiered on Broadway, I want to say, in 2004.
I think it was the other way around with Stephanie J. Block that workshopped it initially.
Oh, yes, you're right. And then Idina came in.
Idina came in at a later date, because part of the theorizing on it is that at the time, Stephanie J. Block was known for her regional work. She wasn't a name that you could attach to Broadway.
So wonderful, we wish back then we'd understood you'd be making.
Idina Menzel already had Rent and Wild Party behind her.
Oh, yes, you're right. So they brought in Idina Menzel, and then there was further work on the musical. That's when they started gearing a lot of the actual music and the vocals to her voice for Elphaba. Anyway, so I mentioned that it came out around 2004, 2005, because that was also in the midst of the War on Terror. And so when you look at the actual book of the musical, which is the screenplay, there's a lot of different allusions towards the Bush and Clinton administration going on there that was inserted because the book writer Winnie was in that culture and engaging with it. And that also inspired some of how they dealt with the elements of fascism and authoritarianism and political intrigue in the story and watered it down. The Wicked book by Gregory McQuire is very different to the play, we could say, I think. Sunday,
yeah.
Right? It is a lot. It's a lot darker. It's a lot more sexual. When did you read the book? You said recently, right?
I'm still audiobooking it. They've just gone to the Philosopher's Club.
Okay. Oh, God. The Philosopher's Club, by the way, is a sex club in the book.
One thing I find really interesting about the book, though, is that it's a while before you even meet the Wicked Witch of the West. Because a lot of it is like establishing the world that...
There's a lot of world building.
A lot of world building at the start, like the stuff with the Time Dragon Clock and how that ends up starting a new religion and how...
There's three different religions in the thing.
With Elphaba's dad, Frexbar, being this kind of traveling preacher. There's so much dense world building, and then you first meet Elphaba, and then she's just a baby.
Yeah,
so you don't really see much of that character. It does feel like a lot more political, again, me and I haven't finished the book, political musing on what these things are, how we deal with them, how we navigate them, how we respond to them, how we might ignore them.
Yeah, it is a bit of a Wizard of Oz fan fiction about the Iraq War and about the idea of terrorism and faulty leaders. It's been years since I read it, but I remember not necessarily liking it. I never really ventured in the rest of the stories and the rest of the book series beyond that, but I remember finding it really interesting in what it was doing. I don't even know how I'd react reading it now, but I'm really glad you're on this journey.
Journey is the word for it.
I'd say maybe don't give it to your kids this Christmas. Although maybe, because I read a lot of weird books when I was young and this is what happened. You're welcome. Maybe it's worth doing. Just approach it with caution. Since we're on this, how do you feel about some of the changes that they made?
Musically, the changes that were made were so seamless. In my head, I was like, is that in the stage show? Because that feels too well done. That feels too connected to something they just did for the film. Like the little, if you only had one short day. That little bit at the start of One Short Day. I was like, is that in the stage show? I'm sure that's in the stage show. It fits too well. The bits, those motifs from For Good playing throughout it. I was like, is that in the stage show as well? Do they nudge to For Good that often that early? Splitting up Madame Marrable's role to be Madame Marrable and also Madame Coddle. Why have they done that? If it means that Keala Settle's going to be singing down in the second film, then glory to God, let that happen, please. Let her do that, because we're talking about...
Michelle Yeoh, we love you.
Madame Marrable doesn't need to sing. She doesn't need to be a singer.
Although, to be fair, I do love those lines. I do love that the way that's... Many years I have waited. I think it's just a beautiful little melody. Go on.
It is really lovely. And just thinking about the vocal demands of the film and what that means for people to have to be on their good singing, and Keala Settle's in there not having sung a single word, I'm a little bit pissed. I'm like, John Chu, John M. Chu, if she's not singing in the second one, I'll be at your house asking questions.
I am so curious about what they did with the second film, because that is also where Stephen Schwartz, I believe, said there's the new songs are there.
Yeah.
So two new songs. And it makes sense, because the second act of the musical doesn't have a lot of songs. It does, but it's obviously shorter because all second acts are. But the splits, watching the first one, this makes sense. I like this film. The fact that it's 3 hours didn't really grate on me, because this film, I think, just zipped by. I'm in it. I loved it, I didn't really feel any extra weight. I was like sitting down yesterday listening to the soundtrack. I decided to let me just complete the musical. Let me listen to the stage version, the rest of it. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of songs. I like maybe two of the songs that are left. How do you feel about the fact that they split it into two parts?
It took me a while to wrap my head around it. It was, I think, 2 weeks before I saw it, I was like, oh, Act One is just quite literally how the Wicked Witch of the West came to be.
Mm-hmm.
That works as its own contained story. And watching it in the cinema, again, it worked really well. But again, I'm talking as someone that knows the events of Act
Two. What happens next?
Mm-hmm. I know what questions are going to be answered. I know how certain things are likely to appear, or they might not appear. It could be very different. Because they're going to have to really flesh it out as well, because Act Two on stage is 45 minutes.
It is. So it's a short TV show.
It's an episode of Glee. That's Desperate Housewives. They need to really stretch that out, which I think, again, if they're putting in two new songs, and of course, if they stretched out Defying Gravity, stretched out Wisdom Eye, they've added more to Dancing Through Life as well. If they've done that with the songs in Act One, appropriately filled the space, the songs in Act Two, there's scope to do that.
Yeah, there is. And also in Act Two, there are some songs in the stage play that are not on the soundtrack. For spoiler reasons, they were chosen not to record them. And so there is more space for music there, because that's when the changes, the biggest changes in what they did, the translating it between the live stage to the movie version, are going to be evident, because there are subtle, small differences in the story itself in the first act, but they don't feel too significant. But also there are certain things in the story that I think they're going to change because of the politics of the time. And so I'm going to be really curious to not only see how they do that, but also the reception for it. I'm also excited about the idea of Stephen Schwartz entering back into this world and making some new music. I'm intrigued to see what he'll do.
Because he added that extra bit to popular at the end. I think there's a bit of excitement there to what he can add to the show, because he did say that if he had thought of that extra ending to popular when the show first came out, that would be in the show.
He would have added it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a chance for him to riff on something he's done. And I trust his musical instinct. We were talking about the little bits of the motifs that were coming in and out of the music. That's obviously the original musical and a trait of musicals, but the way that it was done so artfully in the film. Yeah. I'm excited to see what else emerges. I would find it really funny if just they do also like a couple of hip hop versions just for the soundtrack.
If Ariana Grande phones Victoria Monet and says,
Yeah.
Look, Victoria,
you are a jaguar with a capital J.
Popular and jaguar rhyme.
I'm thinking I might get a little tan this summer.
But in all seriousness, if Ari and Victoria teamed up to have songs inspired by Wicked or reinterpretations of the text, I wouldn't be mad at that. Let me get the full kind of... I'm thinking of I'm Not That Girl, because Cynthia Rivas sang that like she was Toni Braxton. That was a very Toni Braxton. Give me that full scope.
Do you remember when they did the Hamilton mixtape? They got celebrities, different performers.
Jill Scott. Didn't say no to this.
I love that concept. I just want them to do a mixtape. I remember they did it with Aida. Do you remember back in the day?
Like the Spice Girls or Jerry Hall will do My Strongest Suit or something. Crazy.
Janet Jackson also did one of the songs.
Wait a second.
Oh, I know. I think it's I Know the Truth.
Wait. She did with Elton. Oh my God.
You are dying to listen to it, aren't you?
Oh my gosh. Oh my goodness.
No, it is wild. And let me just tell you, they really modulated that song for Janet. No shade.
I would have given Janet My Strongest Suit, because imagine the boom cackery. Imagine the choreo. She would have been tearing that. Oh.
God, I love Janet. More Janet.
Janet should have been this.
Janet just as Janet. She's from Oz, right? Come on. I did also want to say another thing. We are musical nerds, musical heads. Hire musical theater people to do music. Continue to do that.
Yeah.
Do not stop doing that. That is perfect. Mm-hmm. We have them now. Cynthia's here. And have the side characters with the songs that no one cares about be the stunt casting. We need more of this.
But from Broadway, Cynthia Revo, West End and Broadway, Jonathan Bailey, West End credits. Ethan Slater, he was SpongeBob.
It's like they've forgotten. Role. People have forgotten how movies can make stars. That's what musicals used to do. They used to introduce stars, right?
Exactly.
Hire people who can sing these tracks, because we've not noted the fact that these are all songs on live. Mm-hmm. Thank God they're not all melodyned and auto-tuned to hell and back on the soundtrack. You know what I want next? I want a Hadestown musical movie. Right? And you need singers. We need singers. John Chu, Universal.
It should be, because the way that the world felt real and felt like you could touch it, that kind of realness to it, we need that for Hadestown.
Let's talk about that. A lot of the commentary has also been about the color grading of the film. You mentioned the point about touching it. How did you feel about that?
Girl, people start to complain. People, for infants, this really bothered me, to be fair. This really stuck in my craw, because looking at
God, I've triggered you accidentally.
I'm vexed. I had a conversation about this with a friend last night, Jesus. First of all, you're looking at trailers in your phone. This is not the intended medium for how this film is to be consumed. It's not going to be the right take of it. Secondly, yes, was there like a bit of a more muted colours? Yes. Did that make it seem less colourful? No. Grow up.
When I was sitting there, I was just like, I don't get it. It seems really full of life and colour to me.
And when they got
I watched it in the cinema.
And when you got to the Emerald City, the saturation was brought up.
Yeah.
I did notice it was brighter. Like, I'm sorry, this is heated now. This idea that it's, oh, they should have brought the saturation so it looks more magical. There's more ways to communicate a different and magical world than whacking the saturation up. There's more ways to do that.
I think it also allowed them, directing-wise, to do really beautiful things. I think in The Wizard of Oz, there was a specific moment where they put blue on her, and you don't put blue lights on a black girl, but in this instance...
Sat there and was like, no.
But in this instance, with the green skin, it made it look like she doesn't have a green skin. In that moment, while she was saying, he'll remove my verdigris, really, it was really artful, beautiful. I liked it.
And more practical effects in films as well. It just feels better for it to be like more tactile and real. Obviously, with the animals, you CGI for those. You're not going to train a goat to speak.
But that is my critique. I would have liked for the animals to be puppets or to be people in costumes. I would have just liked that better.
Oh, no, I like that they were just like literally just animals.
CGI made, creatures.
See, what I liked was you got to see all the contraptions that made Dr. Silliman able to do his job. And then see there was already infrastructure in this world to support the animals, and that with the rise of the anti-animal fascism going on, with the rise of that happening, you could see that it was more egregious because the world is already set and primed to have these animals there. If it was people in costumes, they wouldn't have needed to have the pulley systems or the little buttons and all the little things that made the animals able to do their job, because that also implies progress as well. That implies there was some progress that is now being taken back, like when at the top of the film where Elphaba's, I said stop! And then all things fly up into the air and it hits that wall. And it reveals there was a mural of the animal teachers underneath the wizard. It made all those little things feel more deliberate, that they were literally animals. One thing about the animals that bothered me, as a secret zoology girly, what bothered me was that throughout the film, you could see that they didn't just use generic kind of animals. It was specific species. There was a fallow deer. There were flamingos. There was a shoebill as one of the teachers there stood next to Dr. Dillamond. And I was like, that's crazy. A shoebill is a crazy bird to have as a teacher, because those birds are mean.
Birds I never knew you were a zoology girly.
I was going to be the first black crocodile hunter.
Oh my God.
Like, I was...
Not your Bindi Irwin era.
Listen, Sundy Irwin era. Let's go. I'm all for black parents of Elphaba and Glinda, but there's something special. There's something in a white Glinda saying how to fix your hair to a black Elphaba with braids.
Also, there's a moment in Loathing where she's hate your face, your clothes. Oh, that just feels... Ooh. Pointed in this situation.
Like, it hit more. It was like, ooh.
All right, Sundy, before I let you go, I have a series of questions to ask you. You may answer them with a paragraph or a sentence. Starting off, can you please give me your most sapphic moment of Wicked Part 1?
I'm torn between two moments. In fact, no, I'm not. It's one. There's a 2 points in Popular where Kristin, sorry, I've been talking for too long.
Glinda,
with a guy, where she leans in each time under, you will be. And I was like, she's getting the strap.
Is that why she kept doing, no! Because she was excited. She did.
Her face was flushing. And then there was Elfie, your beautiful line, because it felt like it was her first time saying it out loud, instead of it being like a realization she had entirely had, like she's letting herself say this about Elfie.
Yeah, she just had the thought for the first time. She's feeling it. She's feeling the bone. She's feeling the horn. She's getting into it. She's allowing herself to get pink.
Get pink.
Yes, I think for my end, my most sapphic moment The obvious answer is to give it. There was something very sapphic about their goodbye. Maybe it's a good lesbian tragedy when they were crying and holding each other's hands and faces. I hope you're happy. I hope you're happy now. Every lesbian breakup I know ends like that.
What's interesting is that they don't actively say goodbye to each other.
Yeah.
Verbally. They say it in all their actions and responses, but it's that sense of, we know each other so well, we know this is where things divert and split us off.
And it's also a bit like that hesitancy to say goodbye. I'm not going to say it. I'm just not going to say goodbye, because that goodbye means goodbye. And this is not the end of this.
If I say goodbye, it's going to be a breakup. And I don't want this to be that. So we're just not going to say it. So it's my excuse to ring you at 3 a.m.
Falling asleep on the phone. I don't want to hang up. I hope you're happy in the end. You're meant to come in. I hope you're happy, my...
I'm being the orchestra.
Friend. Ridiculous. Moving on. Sundi, can you please give me your most chaotic bi moments?
I want to go for the obvious one, because I'm veering towards a lot of things in Dancing Through Life.
Yeah, that's where my mind goes to first.
Immediately. But there's a lot of bisexual moment. Traumatic moment is, why did he kiss the librarian on the forehead? That is a member of faculty. That lady did not come into work to get kissed by a mature student in front of everyone.
Leave her alone.
Listen, if John Bailey's handing out forehead kisses, then... I know you are a man of honor.
Again? What is with you in this fucking song?
look.
Wrong musical, girl. Get it together.
Not when I'm in Wicked. Not when I'm there in that. By the way, did you know the woman that played Elphaba's mom? She was Mariah in Hamilton.
Is this why? I think this is exactly why you keep bringing it up, because you stan her, number one.
No. What?
You just keep inserting. You just want Sharon to have a moment still, don't you?
Yeah. I'm back in the divas, the top of the show. And what? Uh-oh. Like, I'm not remembering the actress, but that lady was dancing down and she sounded beautiful in that section. I was like, more of she. Bring her back. Get her an act too.
Okay, so for my end, I think my most chaotic bisexual moment is the fact that a Fiero understudy also appeared as a cameo introducing Kristen and Glinda, but no one cares. No one's talking about that. And I find that erasure to be very chaotically bisexual.
That's you, shady heifer. No, I heard that he was a Fiero.
I heard he was a Fiero. I didn't know that personally. I heard it.
I heard it said. I'm not being funny. The moment Kristen and Idina appeared in that sequence, my mind just went, I was overwhelmed. Oh. They could have said anything. They could have said a bunch of slurs. I wouldn't have registered it. I'd have been like, they're here. I'd have been...
not slurs. Okay, we're gonna move on swiftly. Can you, Sundi, please give me your winner of the movie?
My winner of the movie is Stephen Schwartz.
Because
it is very rare that a movie musical will add music and add songs and it work so seamlessly. Work in the sense that, oh, was this not always in the show? The way he integrated these new melodies, moved when some motifs happened, expanded some songs so that Final Gravity could be a big action scene, added sequences so well-fitting that at no point did I feel like this is jarring. Everything felt like this has been well done for film. I know that Hairspray made some revisions to the score for the film, which did make sense. I know that because New Girl in Town, the stage production, was just some backing music used at the end of the Courtney Collins show. Expanding that for a full song, lovely move. Work Shamina Whitman, love that. But Schwartz did that to like the next level. That was my winner of the film. Stephen Schwartz in his pen. Ooh! Went.
I respect that choice. I will say, I think my winner of this movie is Peter Dinklage, because Peter Dinklage is going to get paid for 2 movies and he's only showed up into a studio booth for one.
Hey.
He's my winner. He's fantastic, but he did the least amount of work out of anyone there, and good for him.
He sat there in that studio and gave us hearing Dr. Dylan once speak, it was like, this nigga's teaching. He commands respect in the room. Those kids might have, whomever, Marble might have written them slurs on that chalkboard.
Fen? You just like to Fen, remember?
Stop it.
Okay, moving on. Sundi, please give me your loser of the movie.
My loser of the movie. Oof. Ooh. So this can be character, I don't want to say cast member because everyone was kind of in their bags for this one. Mm. Everyone was like on their A game.
Yeah, everybody showed up. Who's our loser, though? There is a loser in them. Lea Michele. That's my loser of the movie.
Lea Michele.
You know she's mad. Somewhere she's mad.
Do we know if she actually auditioned for that?
I'm pretty sure she did. If she didn't...
She came to his house? She went to his house?
She just kept sending WeTransfer links to everybody involved.
Right. I'm going to say, I'm tempted to say Ethan Slater because we saw like a crumb of what he can do. Whereas everyone else had so much flashy, showy stuff. But
are you sure it's not Sharon? She popped up for exactly one line.
I don't know, though, because people remember the doll. People remember Dulcie Bear. Dulcie Bear's got figures. She's got toys.
Good for her. Good for her.
Yeah, people remember the doll diva Dulcie Bear, mother of the House of Bear. Oh my gosh, this is really challenging because...
You're really struggling.
I'm fighting for my life. I'm going to say Nessa, only because I feel like people aren't looking at her character in terms of post-show conversation with a lot of nuance. Because... Yeah. I've heard people say, oh, Nessa's the most bitch-made character in this movie. She was a bad sister. And there's a nuance there. Like, Nessa is a character who has basically spent her whole life trying to establish some agency. And the only person backing her is her sister that no one likes. She's a wheelchair user who's being robbed of her agency at every turn. Even when she gets to Shiz, Elphabat accidentally, again, ends up bringing a wheelchair back to her. And Nessa's like, girl,
she's Jan from Brady Bunch.
She's very Jan from Brady Bunch.
very that.
So, and people aren't bearing that in mind as to why she might be so cold to Alpha, but that, and she would model her behavior towards Alpha based on her bitch ass dad. Fuck him.
Truly, he's the loser. You know what, I'm glad you died. Gifting that, and I will be watching it on a loop.
Listen, if his arteries didn't get him, I'd have dashed the house on his head top myself, because just rudity, just nasty and rude. Shout out to God to be
nastiness.
Real. Just rudity.
Nasty. Nasty.
Show nasty and show rude.
Show rude. Just show rude. All right, Sandy. Okay, before I let you go, I do actually have one last question that I did want to ask you. So we're in a moment right now where there's a lot of witch media popping up, right? Agatha All Along, which was the previous episode, and now we have Wicked. What do you think that's about? Why is the witch making a comeback at the moment? And how do you feel about it?
Ooh, why is the witch making a comeback? Interesting. I think this is going to sound really woo, but I think there's some kind of cosmic reason as the world shifts to a more concerning socio-political climate. We're having stories about these people that were pushed to the fringes of society, were essentially endowed the ability to reconstruct society outside of its original confines. If we look at the figure of the witch, that iconography in the Western world at least alludes to the feminine domestic role, like the cauldron being a place where the hearth was, where those sorts of cooking being done, the broomstick being something that you use to clean. Original ideas of witchcraft were seen as them doing their domestic roles kind of wrong. Ideas of children getting sick and causes of infertility. And again, over time, we've gone through so many different iterations of the witch, but it all seems to link around these people are doing their assigned identities in a way that is wrong by society standards, comparing the way that witches are perceived in Agatha All Along. Bear in mind, this is Agatha set in a universe where we know there are gods, we know there are aliens, we know that there is magic. The day-to-day people are aware of this, but witches are still having to do their shit underground. Witches are still having to be quite clandestine in their practices and having to navigate what it means to be a witch in that realm. Same with Wicked. Even though Elphaba's magic is one of the few things inherently celebrated about her, it becomes, you know what I'm going to say, it becomes a racialized feature, because it says that she is a wicked witch and she has these wicked powers, and if anyone else demonstrated those powers in that similar way, they will be aligned with her. I've been musing for a while about, is Act One of Wicked about racism? And I'll say it's about intolerance, it's about that direct indifference, but it doesn't become a systemic thing until Madame Marble says so, in which it means any other green girl will be perceived that way and will be racialized in that way. So I think there is some kind of cosmic reason as to why we are getting more stories about these subversive, I was going to say women, but not just women, subversive people doing their roles as assigned by their society in a way that's quote unquote wrong, but not necessarily harmful. It only harms the structure that they're in. Maybe the universe is like giving us a little something as we spiral to hell.
A lot of what you're saying does resonate with me. At the moment, I'm defaulting to this idea that it's down to lamentations about power, specifically in this moment where we're seeing power being concentrated and how capitalism is spreading power. And then we have these cultural anxieties about women. We've always had them, but we're in this inflection point where that anxiety has now also come to the definition of who and what a woman is and can be and should be. And I think that's all in the mix with this sort of figure of the witch, who is a woman with a lot of power and who is often standing outside of society because of those abilities, at least within like storytelling. And then when you think about the actual history of witches or this figure of the witch in our like day-to-day reality and the way that came from anxieties about medicine women, healers after the enslavement of African people in America, brought in their different cultures, different beliefs, different practices. When you think about the position of the traveler community or Romani community, I think the quote-unquote trans issue is also weeding into that as people are challenging these rigid beliefs around gender. Rightly, the witch becomes a way to explore that a little bit, or it's a way that reveals this anxieties that we're all having. So we default to the story and use it to process our feelings about these things. That's where I go anyway, but that's an ongoing conversation. If you'd like to hear me continue it, then please refer back to the Agatha All Along episode and whichever episode comes in after this series.
One thing I wanted to ask you, and maybe this is, let's say, spoiler warning here towards the end. Do you think it will have an altered ending? Things are different.
The actual ending? No, I believe that'll be the same. However, I do feel like because with this iteration of Nessa Rose we could still get the walking scene because not all wheelchair users need to use their wheelchairs all the time.
Well, that's fair. I wasn't sure whether she did or didn't.
I'm not sure either. But her motivation is going to be different now because she doesn't really express. There's no sense of people pitying her because she's a wheelchair user.
I'm not sure if I agree with you because I feel like we have gotten moments.
Ooh,
like the tragically beautiful.
But the characters that do that, those are the characters that we're meant to think, oh, they're in the wrong to think that. Glinda's manipulating her. Madame Coddle is ferrying her around without her wanting that. As an audience, we are not queued up to feel bad for being in the chair. So she all of a sudden starts saying the things she says in the stage show, stuck in this hideous chair with wheels, all of that. That's not been prepped enough to justify that being expressed and then Elphaba using her magic for that. I think what might happen is that her magic will be a way of making Bok love her, which could be the spell that goes wrong.
Yeah, I guess that doesn't affect the position of the shoes, does it? You can still use the shoes with Glinda and Dorothy the way it operates in the play as well. Yeah, I think you're right. That is probably where we're going to get the altered song. I'm hoping that we get that like little refrain like expanded on because it's really a beautiful melody. Then I agree with you though. Yeah, I did pick up on that. It felt like they were handling the Nessa story differently, which I think is a good idea to alter that. I just hope it doesn't cost us that one song that I like.
Without her kind of reading the Grimoire, which kind of doesn't make a lot of sense in the stage show because it's implied that no one else can read it, we do not get her becoming the Wicked Witch of the East. So something about that bit needs to change. Just for my own peace of mind, they got a chance to justify the Cowardly Lion. She never let him fight his own battles. He became a coward. I was like, that's stupid. That's stupid, you little bastard. That's stupid. You don't need to say that shit.
No, yeah, you're right.
I hope No Good Deed has a key change as well. Just a little one.
I'm not mad at it. I love No Good Deed. That is the song for me in the second act that I wait for.
Oh yeah, Boots, yeah.
Yeah, the song that I can throw away is
Wonderful.
As Long As You're Mine.
Oh!
That one too, yeah.
You just don't want to hear a man sing, do you?
It's that, but also I feel that it's a bit of a departure for the sound of the music. Like, obviously there's that like refrain that comes in, but I just find the like rock aspect is very Meatloafy to me, that song. And I don't love it. And I don't love it. Clean up, I do love the last second where she's, I feel a little wicked. I always love that bit. But yeah, no, Wonderful can go.
Yeah. A bit weird now that Elphaba has this one moment of weakness where she's not standing by her morals and she's almost tempted. That feels strange to put in there. But
yeah, I can see that going.
If it's a moment, if it's going to be like Ariana Grande's Viola Davis crying and snotting in the rain.
It won't be.
It won't be that. I know, but imagine.
But I'm so ready for Thank Goodness. I love that number. That's maybe my favorite song. My first favorite song of the musical. Yeah, let's not even talk about it. I don't think we have the capacity.
Right, we don't. Now,
but that will be a good one.
But Sunday, in the meantime, thank you so much for joining me. Sunday, say bye for now.
Goodbye for now. I couldn't be happier. Simply couldn't be happier. No, not sleeping. Because getting your dreams, as strange as it seems, a little, well, complicated.
Oh, now you sing. Now you're singing. Okay. I know that you're a man of honor.
What did your school got said? Here I stand. A woman talking to her man.
That's a good song. People should listen to that one.
That was Jill Scott freestyling for 3 minutes, and I'm here for it.
I just want to see her.
You want to see her sit on the mic stick, don't you?
Yes, I want to see her.
Both hands.
Make that disappear down a gobble, gobble, gobble. Thank you so much for listening. You can find Referential everywhere it is that you get your podcasts. If you are listening on Spotify, just scroll down on the audio page and leave a comment. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Wicked Part 1. If you are watching this on YouTube, then hit the like and subscribe button and press the little bell notification so you find out when the next episode drops. I hope you all had a happy holiday season and a happy new year. If you want to start off this year by doing something nice, why not leave a rating on Apple or Spotify? 5 stars, preferably. It helps people find us. Also, tell a friend if you think they would like this episode. Send it to them. We live and die by word of mouth. So it's really appreciated, and it's been really, really helpful in getting this podcast out there. Until next time, you can find me on all socials at AlsoPurp. That is AlsoPurp. That is on TikTok, Blue Sky, Instagram, whichever other ones I'm not thinking of. You'll find more about the things that I'm up to and more content at my website at www.alsopurple.com. That is AlsoPurple.com. You can find more Sunday on Instagram at Sunday in the Park with periods in between. So that's Sunday, period, in, period, the, period, park. And you can also find them on Blue Sky at JSundi. That is JSUNDI. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll be back in your ear soon. Okay. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
Look! It's Glinda!
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.